Welcome, everyone. This is Henrik. Thank you for tuning in today. You can find more radio programs, videos, news, and other investigations on our website, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Today, we have a different program for you guys. We have father and son team Stephen and Evan Strong with us from New South Wales in Australia to talk about their claim that Aboriginal people set sail from Australia 50,000 years ago. They sailed to and settled in America and visited many other places, including Egypt, Japan, Africa, and India. Their theory is that they were the first Homo sapiens who evolved before the sapiens of Africa and who gave the world art, access, religion, maritime technology, culture, language, and surgery. Stephen Strong is a secondary school teacher with a background in archaeology and education. He was involved in the formation of the Graduate Diploma of Aboriginal Education for the New South Wales Department of Education, writing units of traditional law and contemporary history. He also co-authored the highly successful Aboriginal Australia, a language and cultural kit. Evan Strong has a background in sociology and psychology. And weaved into the story is also that of the Carrion Glyphs, a group of approximately 300 alleged Egyptian hieroglyphs in and around an area that is also known for its Aboriginal petroglyphs. They have developed a lot of their work in consultation with Aboriginal people in Australia, and among their claims is that they have rediscovered a hidden history of our origin as humans. They have written several books, Forgotten Origin, Constructing a New World Map, also Ancient Aliens in Australia, and the latest one, just released, is called Shunned. Stay with us and hold on to your hats as Stephen takes us right into the heart of this story. All right, welcome to Stephen. We say first, good to have you with us. Thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
And welcome to Evan as well. Great to have you with us also.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, you guys have a very interesting story. I've been reading up on your work, watched some of your videos detailing some of the portions of what you've been involved in here in the last few years. Well, I don't know exactly how long you can go through that, how long you've been doing this work, but it's pretty extensive, the whole story, a lot of facets to it. So, of course, we'll do the best we can here to give you guys a chance to outline your proposition and your case, if you will, to our audience. But why don't we try to kind of summarize your journey and work so far a little bit as a way of introducing you both to our audience. So please, guys, take it from the top or how far back you need to go to kind of lead us into it.
Well, we should go back to our birth. We won't go that far back. That's a bit further. Look, it sort of starts for myself. I was a teacher. And over the time I taught, I became more and more involved in Aboriginal issues, Aboriginal people and Aboriginal culture. And I was involved in helping write up the senior studies course for a high school certificate for New South Wales. And it was an evolution. It sort of happened step by step. I became more involved. I sort of won more trust, and my son, Evan, sort of came alongside. And they started just sharing information they haven't given others. And then I got to the stage where I had to make a choice between teaching or writing because we were getting so much information. So I gave up the teaching and started recording and visiting the sites that the elders were showing us. And it basically came out of that, to be honest. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, Ramangeri, the elders of Ramangeri found out about what we were writing and what we'd done, and they asked us to come down, and I went down there. They gave me ceremony, and they basically guaranteed from that point on the information we need would come as we needed it. And that's what's happened. That's how my part of the story begins. Evans is a bit different, mate, isn't he?
Yeah, my background was probably psychology and social science and that type of stuff at university. And just as a whim, I did a little bit of archaeology and anthropology just for fun. And as it turns out, that's the only bit of the degree that I kind of use these days. So, I've just come along as well. And it's nice being part of a process where instead of refuting what the elders say, we kind of listen to what they've got to say, and then we find stuff that fits into their story.
Interesting. So where of all the material would be a good start to kind of lead into the Well, the theory, I guess we could say that very much is in opposition to the mainstream view, both in terms of diffusionism, communication between different cultures, but also obviously even you guys go as far back as origin of the human race, pretty much. But the carry-on glyphs, maybe that's a good place to begin. Of course, a controversial area, but tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, we got involved in there through the back door, Eric, because to begin with, we're doing archaeology in the region, but nowhere near Carry On. Yeah. And we were finding engravings of Unks.
Ocean-going boats.
We found engravings of an ibis-headed man in profile. Now, original people always do two eyes for people, not one. And then we found that the ibis-headed man, his feet were very distinctive of Duramulin. It's the way he's portrayed. He was the god of Fiami. Our equivalent would be Jesus Christ. And we found it was part Egyptian on the top and Aboriginal on the bottom. Then we found another engraving of Duramulin, but he had an Egyptian headdress and was in profile.
Mm.
And we found the Egyptian god of inheritance, and we found it sort of what were hieroglyphs. So we looked at that and thought, well, there's definitely an Egyptian link in here. And then the people who were protecting and fighting for the land around the glyphs rang us up and said, well, we come on board. Well, we did, but the first couple of talks, we wouldn't even talk about the glyphs. We didn't touch it, did we?
No, we talked about everything around them but them.
We just didn't want to touch it because, I'll be honest, we didn't come in as converted or someone who was part of the campaign to save the land or the glyphs. We came in from 600-700 k's away and knew very little. So to begin with, we had no interest. And the first time we went on the glyphs, I looked at it and I thought, yeah, there could be something there. But it wasn't enough. It really wasn't enough to begin with. So our involvement in this was very much through the back door and very much to begin with, well, yeah, the glyphs are interesting, but we're more concerned about all this other Egyptian stuff we found around there. Well, we found rock engravings of all original, and right in the middle you find an Egyptian sign, and we found this time after time. So to begin with, there was no interest in the glyphs. We just sort of looked at that as an interesting diversion.
Hmm.
So we didn't come with an agenda or anything to prove. We actually came very cynical to begin with. A lady by the name of Auntie Minnie Mae Snelder. This is what started our conversion, if that's the best way to put it, because we don't lead anywhere. We wait for the elders to point and tell us what needs to be done. And then we decide, okay, we know this is true. We move forward, but we don't do what other archaeologists do when they walk on board with an idea what the answer is. We wait to be given that. Now, Arnie Minnie got in contact with us, and she actually went on site long before, and she gave us two artifacts, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She gave us a bone artifact and a metal artifact.
Now, the metal artifact was the one that really got us going, because what it was a complete clasp, a perfect circular clasp. And a chain was worn by her children for a while. They walked around there and used it as jewelry. Now, it was found between the two walls, and Auntie Minnie said it took a half an hour to clean up.
Hmm.
And it looked very, very light. I've given it to metallurgists, and they can't identify what metal it is, but they're telling us it's not magnetic, it's not iron ore, it's not copper, it's not brass, it's not all the things that Europeans would have used in our country. So that began the equation. But what she also gave us was what she said was the bone. And she thought it could have been the bone of the Egyptian son of the pharaoh that died there, Neferteru. And we said, oh, gee, that looks a bit different. But 4,500-year-old bones, none of us have great expertise in this. So what we did was we went to the local hospital, and I went to the practice unit and showed it to someone. He said, it's ancient, and it looks like a hip bone. He said, but I can't be sure. But what we could do is get a CAT scan done on it. I said, well, that's fine. I don't have the money for that. To cut a long story short, they closed the hospital up and gave us 1 hour and closed the whole facility down and gave it six times the normal radiation because he said the patient won't mind. We got a computer readout. They told us they weren't sure because they've never worked with ancient bones, but what they did tell us was it had exactly the same density as a human bone. So what we started to have there was a couple of clues, but not enough. But it certainly did point us in that direction. Because as I said, we're coming from the point of view, we'd written three books for University Press of Australia, America, rather, and we wanted science.
Yeah.
We had an indication. but we needed a bit more. The next thing we ran into, and we've only just got the map for this 3 days ago, and this did push us over, I've got to be honest, was directly above the glyphs, directly above it, was a set of star markers.
So they're like cupules.
Cupules, they're like in grey.
Just to clarify this, what area are we in, and which glyphs are this, if there are several around?
We're at Carry On now, and we're probably 20 metres up the hill and 10 metres to the side, the first set of glyphs there, sort of cupules there. Now, somebody got them charted and sent them to Sydney Uni, and they came up with a date of 2500 BC, which is about 4,600 years ago, which is exactly the same time these two brothers were supposed to be here. Now, we thought to ourselves, what are the chances the original people have gone up the top and just by pure chance managed to knock up exactly the same time as when they came? Now, that map was lost, and everyone spoke about it and whispered about it, but they knew.
It's like a myth almost.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, 4 days ago, we won't go into the reason why, we got that map, and it was from Sydney Uni, and it does say July the 19th, 2500 BC. Now, that started to push us in the direction of what's going on here. Then, the next step, it's a gradual process, but this is how things have got to happen. If you're going to be scientific about this, you've got to be overwhelmed by evidence. Behind the glyphs, there's a shaft. Now, the National Parks and Wildlife, from the time they found the shaft, filled it up with about 4 tonnes of rubble. And it's been like that ever since. And there have been a couple of pictures, but everyone says they were photoshopped. Well, I won't go into details how, but the time before we went there with the camera, the day before, I don't know how this happened, Evan, do you?
No.
Somebody must have got there, some people must have got there and lifted out all the 4 tonnes of rock. And lo and behold, the day we get there, it was all moved out. I won't go into the reasons how that happened, because that would be illegal, so we wouldn't be involved in that, would we? We sent people down. There, have a look at our website. Has a massive shaft of about 10 metres, parallel lines. You can see the chisel marks. The reason they filled it up is because it's obviously artificial. It's obviously been man-made. Now, there's stories going around that it's a fake.
Well, right.
Maybe some like fake glyphs, but are you going to dig out 50, 500, 600 tonne of sandstone and chisel away like that? That really pushes the odds greatly towards the fact there's something unusual taking place here. Now, I went there a couple of days ago, and lo and behold, National Parks and Wildlife have been back in there, and they're dropping the rocks back in again. They don't want people to see it. So by now, Henry, we're starting to really think, what's going on here? But for us, the clincher is this. The real clincher is this. The claim is it's fake, that maybe a deranged Yugoslav or a bunch of uni students or a
World War One
veteran did it. There's so many stories, but we don't have a name. But it's always about those two walls. We found more glyphs, different glyphs, much smaller, a different incision, much shallower, and one-third the size.
In the same, on the same walls?
No, somewhere a long way away. See, this is the difference.
Ah, okay.
The fake is supposed to be between the walls. This is a long way away from there, nowhere near there. No one knows about it. It was only found 2012 by Jay Kassar working with us. Now, the trick is, when you read it, down the bottom, the last three glyphs say as following. The first one is coffin. It's a sign for coffin. The second one, and we didn't know this, but we've got an Egyptologist who helps us, is a special shaft that can only be taken by the pharaoh, the son of the pharaoh, when they're interred. And they carry this to the other side that's got inscriptions on it that ward away evil spirits. That was there. And the last glyph said back shaft. Now, we've just been to the back shaft, and that's where he was supposed to be buried. Now, these glyphs, and it's got a direction marker pointing back to where the back shaft is. Now, when we saw that, we said to ourselves, okay, if this is a fake, this is becoming the most stunning piece of hoaxing that I've ever seen, because this person has been so duplicitous. They've made a different set of glyphs, one-third the size, nowhere near as deeply cut, that refer to the back shaft, not to the walls, but to the back shaft where Nefertiti was supposed to be buried. Now, by this time, we were really starting to lean over towards there's something legitimate about that. But then comes the cruncher. We then got in contact with the elders now, because it was time now for us to ask, and the time was right. So we went and saw the two elders that were most involved in this. And it's on our video, I think, Egyptians in Australia, part two.
Yep.
Gave us the absolute clues. They gave us the rest of the story. Arnie Bev Spears, the last dark and young elder of full descent, the one that was given proper initiation in the middle. She told us the original women used to go up there because it was Egyptian. And this was the first time she'd said this, wasn't it, Evan? They used to go up there and coat it with their urine to harden the glyphs, so they stayed there. And this was part of what they used to do to look after it. Then the National Parks and Wildlife Sites officer that was working for them told us the story about how they were really found. Now, if you go to the records, Parks and Wildlife will tell you they found it in 83. David was taken there in 1978. Now, to begin with, he'd heard about it, but they would not give it up. So he found a site. He took pictures of it, and he took it, and he said, look at this amazing site. They said, brilliant, take us to it. You're our site officer, take it to it. He said, no, I won't. You've got to take me to these glyphs I've heard about. That was the only way he was going to give up the other site. So he basically bribed his way in. There he went, 1978, 5 years before they claim in their records they saw it. He was told, he was sworn to secrecy on the evidence. He was told he can't say a word about it. They took him there at dusk, and he saw them. And he said the first thing he noticed was tons and tons and tons of rubbish that had fallen in between the two walls. Now, he went back there for 2 days with a work crew of six, and they cleaned it out. And he said there was decades and decades of rubbish there. So this story about 2 years before, someone walking in there with a chisel, no hammer, and just making all this is a load of rubbish. It's a lie. It's a straight-out lie. And then he went further, and we've since had confirmation, and this is what really blew us away. Those two walls were covered by a rock ceiling. And in 1961, council workers, when were making a rubbish tip, drove over the top of it, and it collapsed and fell in. So until 1961, these glyphs had been there for 4,600 years, and they've been sealed off. And everyone says, oh, they can't be. They can't be legit because they look so new. Well, for all intents and purposes, they're only 50 years old. Because they were sealed away and then treated by the women. Now, once two original people told us the story, that's when we started talking. I know it's a long story to get to it, but to begin with, I want to make the listeners clear.
Yeah.
We were taken along with all the other red herrings. Of course, the beautiful story about the Sydney Uni students were supposed to engrave this. Is the thing is, they said, oh, well, they got all the cartouches wrong because they put the birds around the wrong way. Well, in the most ancient of ancient Egyptian glyphs, there is one glyph, 1231, where the birds are facing the wrong way, which means I welcome you. But forget that. Say they actually are telling the truth. What's fascinating is these so-called students of archaeology, first year at Sydney Uni, did the birds the wrong way, and above each of the glyphs, above each of the cartouches where the birds are facing the wrong way, they did a bird above facing the right way. Now, somehow, these idiots, who are now the archaeologists running around the whole of this country, didn't realize they were doing it back to front. Now, that's the official story, or the deranged check in 1975.
Uh-huh.
But we know there was tons and tons, he said decades and decades of rubbish that had fallen in there, probably ever since 1960, when the, and we can find the ceiling in, on the floor, can't
we? Yeah, there's bits of the ceiling still left.
It's still there.
Right.
Now, when you put all that together, with the elders directing us, we now know it's legitimate. And since then, elders have come from all over the country to reconfirm and reaffirm time after time, oh, yes, the Egyptians did part of the walls.
Mm.
That's what we also learned.
That's an important part.
Huh, interesting. So is there... One of the things I heard as well then is that there is a possibility that some have, because the site, as I understand it, is not really protected per se, and there have potentially been alterations, or someone has tried to, maybe not even in some instances nefariously try to change them, but they've carved them again to make them even more clear. But nonetheless, there are potential alterations along some of them, like the alleged Anubis glyph, correct?
Correct, and actually we are fully behind that. The Anubis glyph, I don't believe, is legitimate, and there's about four reasons. Number one, it's not engraved as deeply, is it, Evan?
No.
And secondly, the whole of these walls are symbolic statements about God, about spirituality, about our origins, but none are specific. There's no other Egyptian god given up. It's about four times bigger than any other symbol there. It's out of sync. It doesn't belong anywhere else, and we've seen pictures of the ears being added to.
Right.
So we have no doubt. But I'm going to say now, Henry, there may be one or two others that maybe could have been added to, but most of it is a continuous narrative, and it honestly is carved the same way throughout. But Anubis, people keep trying to read things into this, and we always say, don't bother. Don't bother. We have no doubt. I mean, we could be wrong. We have very little doubt that that is a fake. And, of course, what that does, as you know, you throw one rotten fish in the basket, and everyone focuses on the rotten fish, and they don't look at the rest of the basket.
Sure.
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
So we make it very clear, yes, that was added to. No doubt about that. But we also make it clear, when you talk about the glyphs, please talk about the shah, talk about the other glyphs, talk about the artifacts that have been shown, found, and talk about the engravings. And by the way, within about 4 km of that place, we have found so far over 3,500 individual star markers, all pointing to the sky up above. So this place has got much more to it than just the so-called fake two or three walls.
Plus, we found another crystal embedded metal object. We still don't know what that is.
Yes, we found an object right very close, about 50 meters away from the two walls.
Mm-hmm.
It's part metal, part crystal, and the crystal is part of whatever it is. Now, this is in the middle of bush, in the middle of nowhere. My question would be, what would be a sophisticated... Well, we've only been putting metal and crystal together quite recently, and it looks ancient. What's it doing in the middle of nowhere, underneath the dirt there? So all those things, when you talk about the glyphs, we try and say to everyone, don't talk about the glyphs on their own. Talk about the site where the glyphs are a part of it.
So it's a hole there. And obviously there are many details here that I wanted to try to get closer to and explain this a little bit more also to our audience here. But first of all, would you say that the glyphs are straight out Egyptian, or is it a unique style that kind of lends from various early languages? How would you guys describe it?
That's a brilliant question, and that's the one we're hoping you ask.
Yes.
There are actually three walls there, not two as people say. Now, we believe there are, and we've isolated them. We put it in that e-book with Bruce and Danielle, didn't we, Ancient Origins in Australia. We just focused on that. What we found was this. We've got a book which is Proto-Egyptian, the first form of Egyptian, that was done up in cooperation with Egyptian authorities, and Dr. Abu Dia Ghazi was involved in this with Ray Johnson. And she said, and they worked for the Cairo Museum of Antiquities. She said that compendium they used was the right one. It's the most ancient form of Egyptian. So we used that as our base. If you look at the narrative relating to the two brothers coming here and they're both being stranded and someone dying, we got an 82% match with the glyphs in the book and what was on the wall. And we believe that is Egyptian. But here's the trick, Henrik. If you take that section apart, the rest of it, we got a 44% match. And a lot of critics have said, well, look, this part doesn't look Egyptian. No, it isn't. We believe the rest of it is a different narrative that's more ancient. And as Arnie Bev said, and she told us in this video, the Egyptians came here to learn hieroglyphs. The original people were already doing it. Now, I know this sounds radical, but we believe the original people were the first people to write, and the rest of those walls are more ancient. And in there, the match is 44% because I believe, and we all believe this, that Proto-Egyptian we worked for the first part is the derivative language that comes from that language. Now, other scholars have said they've seen Sumerian stuff there, they've seen Babylonian stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
So they should. It's the base language.
A root language.
The root language that all other languages formed out of. So, yes, it's definitely two narratives there. And, of course, the problem is, when you start to look at the second narrative, the more ancient narrative, well, that's the section where, and of course within the glyphs there, the most common glyph, there are seven icons for God and there are eight for UFOs. That's the part of the story we found quite interesting.
Tell us a bit of what the conclusion are that these are UFOs.
Oh, well, because everyone has seen them. That's what they call them, the UFO glyphs. It's because you've got the semicircle, the half a semicircle on top with the legs coming off, and they're obviously flying. It's something that even the critics, they use it as a major critique. Well, New Ages must have put these UFOs in because they don't exist. They all call it that. I mean, if you look at the pictures, we've got some up on our website, you'll see it. It really is obviously that. So it's sort of like, and some, you've got some that are actually look like they're crashing, don't they? They've been placed upside down.
Yep.
What we think is when we looked at this, we looked at the start of it, and we thought we saw absolute proof that this is the star, the section that is what we would call extraterrestrial starts with an icon, which is the icon for man. It's a stick figure, which hieroglyphs don't do. And then after that, we see a repetition of one symbol, which is three circles. Now, in the book we've got, 2800, the three circles represent chemical. Now, what they've done with these three circles, they've stacked them on top of one another and given them legs. But as you go through the narrative, then they have arms. And further on, they have two pyramids in their arms. And then you see a pregnant woman. And it looks to me like there's a division. And then you see the three circles again with a shaft bisecting it right through the center. And next to that is the icon for father. And what we started to read there, Enric, was what we thought was a very strong indication of something came here and made something. And you can see it slowly growing, can't you, Evan?
Yep.
Into a proper human with three circles, two arms, two legs, and things in his hand. And we think the first part of that narrative refers to the creation of a new being, which we might refer to as Homo sapiens, but it looks very strongly like that. Then further on, you've got this narrative. You've got the symbol for Mu. You've got symbols for ancient city, ancient civilization scattered all the way through there. So what we also know, and we're working a lot with Hout and Klaus Dohner on this, is we think this particular area was way back, and I'm talking hundreds of thousands of years ago, an ancient civilization. And it was destroyed. And we think that's part of what that story is. It's quite radical. We tend to, when we go to mainstream, just sit with the Egyptian part of the story and have a lot of grief with that, I can assure you. They have enough trouble with that. But when we want to try and take them back hundreds of thousands of years and knowing we can see the symbol for Mu sitting in front of us, and we also saw the symbol, according to Churchwood, who had a look at the work we're doing, of empire of, as it is in Lemurian language. And we're so sure that there's a story there about ancient people coming from the stars, landing here, starting something up, living here, then civilizations following, then the Egyptians coming here because they're part of this story. They were coming because of what had taken place before.
And of course there's a replication of that UFO glyph, but in a completely different
place. Oh, yes.
Can't forget that one.
Yeah, that UFO glyph we spoke about, the largest UFO glyph there. We found another one. Klaus reckons it's the biggest in the world. Now this UFO glyph is over 2 meters across and 4 meters long. And what we noticed straight away when we looked at it was identical. It had five legs, like the ones between the two walls. It had the same cylindrical shape. It looked exactly the same as the one between the walls. So we did some maths, Henry. And what we found was this, that the biggest UFO between the two walls of Charyon is 19 centimeters across. This UFO, which is about 4 km away, is 190 centimeters across. So we got a number of 10 then. And then we decided we'd go down. But the difference is, the UFO we've got, the big one, has got two stories, hasn't it, Evan?
Yes,
it does. It's got a line between the semicircle to break it up in two. So we thought, okay, this is double as big. So we multiplied everything by 20, going vertically. And this is what we found. But the UFO glyph between the two walls is 7.5 centimeters. But if you double that, it's 15, and multiply by 10, you get 150. The UFO engraving near the ocean is 150 high, exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Then we measured the longest leg between the two walls. It was 8.4. You double that, 16.8 times 10, 168. Well, guess what? The longest leg of the five UFOs was 168 centimeters. So we got three numbers that are identical, the same shape. And Ani Bev tells us, for the first time ever, she lets out a bit of information each time. She said, today I'm going to talk about the star people. We'd never heard about it before. And she spoke about the carriers from up there. That's what she calls them, doesn't she? The carriers from up there. And spoke about a UFO that crashed in the waters of Bambara. This UFO overlooks the waters of Bambara. We believe this was chronicling crash of a mothership. I know it's radical.
Tell us a little bit more about Bev, who she is, for our audience who don't know.
Okay, Aunty Bev Spears, when we go onto country, wherever we go, we go and find the elders, the ones that we have to talk to before we can walk onto their country, because we don't have the right to walk on original country. I've been initiated, so has Evan. Evan's been given ceremony. We can't do it any other way. Aunty Bev is the last in a long line of Darkinyong. From what we can work out, the last full descent Darkinyong elder left. And she's the keeper of the sacred stories for the Darkinyong. And she's the one we work with all the time and we always consult. Because we believe this. The original people were in this country for hundreds of thousands of years. And they kept their oral stories intact, passed on from generation to generation. Now remember, in Australia, no tribe can invade and walk on another tribal estate. They can't take it, they can't steal it. So your history stays intact here. In other countries, invaders take a place and they change the history. Here it never changes. Therefore, when Aunty Bev, who is the keeper of lore and ancient stories, tells us information like that, we know it's true. So that's how we do this. And it's interesting, Aunty Bev has gone with us. And as we've learned a bit more, she shares us a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I work with another elder, the Ramanjeri, Kano.
Yep.
He does the same thing.
Yeah.
He gives you a little bit. He gives us to it in riddles, doesn't he, Evan?
Yep.
Which I never get, do I?
But he has special words for this, what we're all doing here together. He calls it Wirigin, which is white fella, black fella dream.
Yeah, this is what they want to do. The original people want to share all of their past now. They've kept it secret for 220 years. But under Wirigin, black fella, white fella dreaming, they want to give it all up now. And that's what we're a part of. So when we did our last piece of archaeology, we had 10 different elders on site. This is the way we work. And they guide us, and they give us direction. So Aunty Bev, when we go down to that place, we must always see her first. And before we go on to site, we're given ceremony again, and we let the spirits know why we come, what our intentions are, and how we're going to honor them.
So tell us a bit more of why you guys think this is the time to give away this or share the knowledge, get it out there. Why now?
Look, I can only relay back because we are basically, what we're doing is we basically realize, no more, no less. I'm very careful. If I get a word wrong, don't worry about that.
They certainly do.
If I make a mistake, I get told straight away. But it doesn't matter who I spoke to over the last year and a half. Evan's running the same thing. When the elders come and give us stuff, they always give us a rule. The rule is this, get it out this year. 2013, last year it was 2013 again. It must get out before the end of this year. They keep saying the same thing. And what they say is this. They tell me this, and I mean, I'm only passing this on. They're utterly convinced there is a massive change afoot. And they don't refer to the Mayan calendars and stuff like that. This is what they say themselves. And they want their own people and the non-original people to know the truth, to know the real way, the way things were in this country before the whites came and before anyone came. And they want other people to know that. And they want to share their history. And their history, Robert Bevel was talking on that radio show not recently with us, wasn't he? He said this is going to rewrite world history. They want that. They want to rewrite world history. Because our heritage and our past has been stolen. You see, Henry, we're convinced today that we're warlike, belligerent creatures. And our testosterone, we just can't control it. And for the last 5,000 years, all we ever do is fight. And we spend half the money on this planet on killing people. On how to do it.
Well, probably more, this, yeah.
Probably more, yeah. According to the story we've got, no, we're not. The story we've got on the sacred mound and the story that's also in those lists is that we are peaceful, spiritual, cooperative beings that have been lied to. And because our heritage has been stolen, we're fearful. And when you are fearful, your mind and your spirit are still. What we're trying to do is to make people unfearful by finding out what we were like to begin with. I've read the sacred language, and I've got to tell you, we've fallen massive amount from where they were then, ancient ways. Their wisdom was unbelievable. What we have today is an embarrassment. The way we speak today and what we write about today. No, we're trying to put back that which was stolen, that which was taken from us. The original people are the first people, and when they went out a long, long time ago, as the Ramanjeri told us way back, and circumnavigated the world in the figure eight. They gave the dreaming for the rest of the world until about 8,000 years ago. Everyone lived a hunter-gatherer society, and they worked with the spirits and with the land. That's what the dreaming is. And then money and cities and farming appeared, and there was a separation of the ways. What the original people are saying is, you've had a separation, you've had your time in the sun, well, not in the sun, in the clouds. They want to bring back their old ways. They want to talk about different ways of doing things, the spiritual way of doing things, the powers they have, the wisdom they have, and they want to share it. This is what it's all about. They just want to share their past.
Now, if we're getting to the timeline a little bit here in terms of, and I was also interested in, very much in listening to this because it also goes a little bit against of the out of Africa theory, and in this regard we have a different take on things, obviously. But give us still a bit of a timeline of what you guys think happened in terms of the spot, if you will, or this area. We're in New South Wales, if that's where the origin of this is, pretty much, and then we have a diffusion from that area into other places around the world, and then it seems to have been a kind of a returning, if you will, then, that the Egyptians are seeking, they are seeking their origins and are coming back and traveling back to that area again, if I correctly understand that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Look, we can give you a date, and it's not our date, is it,
Evan? No.
We'll give you the date of, look, when they did the Out of Africa theory, we have the paper that was written by Professor Alan Wilson and Rebecca Cairn. Now, what needs to be understood, Henry, in that paper, they spoke about this fictional league that we've all heard about 150 to 200,000 years ago. They said probably Africa. People didn't get that. The paper doesn't say, you can't do genetics and geography. You can get an idea, but you can't be precise about that. They said probably. What people don't know was that in 10 years, both of them said, no, not Africa, Australia. And neither of their papers were published because it didn't fit. Now, the reason we got 400,000 years is because when they did that paper, they made up a time clock and they used two events that took place in Australia to calibrate their clock. And the two events were, they said the original people got in Australia 50,000 years ago and they've got one third the genetic diversity of the rest of the people in other places, therefore being the youngest. And then what they said is 50 to 60,000 years, one third the diversity of Africans. Three times that's 150 to 180,000 years, there's your date. That's how they did it. What they didn't know is both Rebecca Cairn and Alan Wilson came to Australia and did mitochondrial surveys. And they found the opposite. And what they found, and I'm going to use a quote from Alan Thorne, is the mitochondrial DNA in Australian fossil is much more primitive than anything. That's Thorne.
Oh, Thorne.
Much more primitive than anything that's been found in Africa. And there's no archaeological physical evidence to support the idea that Australian Aboriginals originated from Africa. Now, that's what Wilson and Cairn also said. The reason being, when they came down here to do mitochondrial DNA surveys, they were getting amazing diversity rates of 75%. In fact, Wilson did two surveys and got 22 different strands from 31 full descent people. Now, here's the problem. 22 different strands, each strand represents 3,500 years a population has been in an area. Well, 22 times 3,500 is 77,000 years already. But he only surveyed 31 people. He then said, what if I surveyed more? Now, Wilson is the one who said, after doing all this work, as he died, the year before he died, he said, it may be, I think I can really know this one, don't I?
Yeah.
It may be too far out to admit, but while Homo erectus was muddling around in the rest of the world, in Australia, he did something different. He came to Australia, and it's here that he first evolved into Homo sapiens. And he gave a date, around 400,000 years.
Hmm.
What we're finding with every mitochondrial survey done of the original people, they are too diverse. Their ancestry goes back so far. There was a study done of 600 vials of full descent blood by Roy Simmons, wasn't it?
Yes.
From the Commonwealth Serum Laboratory. He studied it, and he said exactly the same thing. He said, oh, nothing African here, much more primitive, and more to the point, they kept detecting two lineages, and here's the clue. Rebecca Cairn said there's two lineages here. They did studies of Y chromosomes and said there's two lineages here. Okay, one's Homo erectus. We've got that. We'll accept that. They said Homo erectus came here. All right, he came here. There's nothing here, he gets here. And then him, along with something else, makes Homo sapien. What's the something else?
Yeah.
It can't be another hominid because they're all in the rest of the world. You know what I mean? You've got Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon. They're everywhere else. But only Homo erectus got here. They said only Homo sapien was here. Wilson and Cairn are saying Homo erectus got here. And then something happened here with another strand that he can't identify. That's what we're working on. So, look, we've got plenty of evidence.
You've got the Denisovians in Siberia.
Yeah, look, the closest link in the world to the Denisovians in Siberia is Australia. The closest mitochondrial link is Australia. There are too many questions like that that don't make sense. And I read the article they wrote, and they said, oh, well, we can explain this. The Denisovians must have sailed from Siberia to Australia at one stage. Now, they're breaking the rules, Henry, because they said that only Homo sapiens could make boats.
Right.
Now they're saying a lesser species, a tiny little lesser species, which is most directly related to Australians, sailed all the way from Siberia to Australia.
Well, everyone else has to walk on the ice or something, you know, it can never be the boat kind of thing. But in this case, it works then, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, so what we've found is when you look at all this evidence, all the mitochondrial evidence and the Y chromosome evidence, because what people probably don't know, the Y chromosomes, which is not as good an indicator, in Australia, there's 41 types of Y chromosomes. In Australia, 80% of them are found in two groups. Only country in the world like that. I'm getting back to those two groups again, no matter how you do it. And some of the other strands of Y chromosomes are not found anywhere else in the world. In fact, if I can leave it with this, the oldest Homo sapien found on this planet is Mungo Man. He's 60,000 years old. That's got to be when the Africans just got here, right? It's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
They got some mitochondrial DNA out of his little finger, and they analysed the mitochondrial DNA. And you know what they found? They called it an extinct gene. They couldn't recognise it. They should have been able to recognise it. If it's 60,000 years old, he's just walked off the boat, for God's sake. He's only been there for 2 seconds, and he should be exactly African. The interesting part of where they found this is this position is about 3,000 kilometres from any northerly entry point. It's right in the middle of Australia, Lake Mungo, in the middle.
Right.
What is he doing in the middle straight away? It would have been on the beach to begin with. So the more you go into this story, and we've got at least 10 sites where people are given dates of over 60,000 years in Australia. So what we've got is so many archaeological irregularities that don't fit into any out of Africa theory. And if you ask the original people, they gave us the answer. Our dreaming is from here. We were made here. And don't forget, their gods are not called gods. They're called sky heroes. And there's one story, one dreaming story that goes to every tribe, all of the 500 tribes, because each tribe has their own language, their own stories. But there's one story that goes everywhere. The seven sisters. And the seven sisters are Pleiades, the Pleiades.
Well, this is fascinating. Of course, there's a lot more to this, and I want to ask you guys a whole lot more about this in the next segment here. In a little while, we're going to take a break, but I want to give you some time as well to talk more about the books that you guys have out there right now. You have a latest one that I want you to mention, and then I want you to give out some details about the website so people know where to go to, you know, read more about your material and see videos, etc. So please go ahead, guys, and let's dig into that.
Well, we've got three books published by the University Press of America. So that's Constructing a New World Map, Mary Magdalene's Dreaming, which is a comparison between Gnosticism and the original dreaming here, and then another book called Forgotten Origin. And then there's the ebook, which is available from our website, which is Ancient Aliens in Australia.
And then we've got the book that's coming out that our editor's working furiously on all the time, which is called Shun. And that one, in some respects, is probably where I'd recommend most people start, simply because in that we sort of sum up what we wrote in the first three books, didn't we?
Yeah.
And put it into one book and give people an encapsulation of all the science we've got.
Right.
And as Evan mentioned, we're a great believer in looking in religion to find history, because up until 4,000 years ago, nobody wrote history books. All the history was written inside religious chronicles. So we look at Gnosticism, we look at all the religions, and we trace the dreaming through that too. So in Shun, we look at the religious link up, we look at mitochondrial DNA, we look at the genome study that was just done with the 100-year-old hair of an Aboriginal person, where the group decided, oh my God, yeah, Aboriginal people aren't last, they're at least equal first with the Africans. And then they try and deal with that, and they can't work out why that came out too. So we go through all the science in Shun, so that then, when we go on to all the stuff we're talking about now, when we start talking about the fact that everyone came to this country, they don't look at us like, well, what are you talking about? Yeah. Why would they do that?
Yeah. Right.
No, it's not Africa. It's not Africa. We actually believe that the original people were sailing around this world six figures, way, way back. And look, I can tell you what the elders will say, and we've got a quote we use all the time. It says this, all other peoples of the world come from us, and that's what they tell us.
And then on YouTube, there's six parts, I think, to Egyptians in Australia. So
yeah,
see a little bit of a rundown of what happens out in the field.
Yeah, that's a very good one, too, because it shows, obviously, a lot of the glyphs that we have been talking about so far. And I think you, Stephen, ran kind of through some of them and detail what they mean more or less there. So.
Yeah, and, of course, when we did that, I've got to tell you, some of that stuff, we were dancing in the dark, and we realized some of the things we said in the first thing aren't right. But we're quite happy to do that. A lot of people who are working in this field try and hide their errors. We embrace them. Because an error means, once you acknowledge that error, it means you're moving forward anyway. So some of our readings are wrong. To begin with, we thought this was all Egyptian. We now know better. We now know there's an original language that goes before that. And of course, the site, hopefully we get to talk about a bit further on, actually quantifies that in more detail. But what we have found is now, is these people have got a history that honestly, it's not just an Australian history, it's a world history. It's the beginning of humanity. And I think we really need to understand that what their story is not the one we've been reading in any of the approved books and any of the curriculums. I used to be a teacher, and I had to stop because I couldn't bear teaching the stuff I was teaching. This is a story that everyone needs to know about.
Very interesting. Now, regarding Shunned, will that be a paperback, and do you guys know when that will be out?
It's going to be an e-book and paperback, and I know that our editor is probably, as we speak, he probably will have it out when this show goes to air, and that's what he's trying to do. Because we would like that as our base, because from that we've got another book that will be coming soon after, and we're putting a series of articles now up in Wake Up World, particularly on the, it's quite funny, in one respect now, we're bored with the Egyptians, aren't we, Evan? It's such, we're over it. We've got about 80 pieces of evidence, and we're thinking, oh, we're not even interested in that. It's such a done thing. What we want to work out is we're working with Klaus Gruner at the moment down in Carry On. We've so far found two sites that Klaus has marked out for us, and with this machinery I can't even talk about. Still got 148 to go, and they're all ancient, way past Egyptian. That's where the real interest is now.
Interesting. Now, give us, before we wrap things up with the first segment here, then, give us the website, the URL, so people know where to go to check out all this work and for the upcoming books as well.
ForgottenOrigin.com, and there'll be links to the YouTube there, to all of those books. There are links to buying the first free on Book Depository, and you can actually buy the e-book from that site as well, the Ancient Aliens one in Australia. Yeah, and it should give everyone a bit of a good rundown of our theory and everything.
And we'll put Shunned up the sentences out too, yeah.
Yep.
And then we've got about three more books to come.
Well, it sounds good. The research is continuing, as it were. All right, well, we'll have these linked up on redicecreations.com, Forgotten Origin, and Wake Up World as well. All right, Stephen and Evan, stay with us. We'll be right back with more. Wake up, baby, 'cause I'm coming to you from the future. Now don't be surprised when I'm sitting at the foot of your bed. I bring you a life you could never see in the daytime. Planting the seed of my purpose in your head. right. Well, we have more to talk about. Obviously, we'll get more into the myths connected to this origin story in the next hour. We'll also discuss the new archaeological finds that have been made very recently and what approach they have to these findings. There are some startling and extraordinary claims of finds that have been made, and we ask more about who is to oversee this work and what is next in order to secure some of these sites. Maybe there are risks of cover-up, or maybe just a non-interest from the part of authorities in Australia. But the question is, where will these results take our understanding of human origins? There are many more unanswered questions, and we'll try to get to some of these in the next hour. RedIceMembers.com is the website for members and anyone who want to acquire a subscription and download or stream all of our programs, both ours and all other content that we have available for you guys. And before we proceed, I'll let you know that we'll return on Monday with Klaus Bandpaintner for more on the travesty of the Swedish model being promoted internationally. Some stuff in there that you've never heard before. Very interesting. Later, Ingrid Kalkvist, James Swagger, Steve Gorham, and Jason Erb. Stay tuned now then to Hour 2 with Stephen and Evan Strong at RedIceMembers.com. We'll talk to you there.